I remember when I started, I picked it because it was brutally hard. And I picked it and started it, I want to say around 38 years old, I'm 56 now. It's had tremendous impact, tremendous, tremendous impact. You need to be resilient, right? You own a business, you know that not every day is a win. And if you're not resilient through the ups and downs of business ownership, then you're probably not going to be in business for long.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to another episode of Trial Lawyer View, where I'm joined by Thomas Tona. He's the founder and managing attorney of Tona Law in New York City. With over 30 years of experience as a trial attorney, Thomas has built a reputation for excellence in personal injury and no-fault litigation. Known for his relentless dedication to justice, he has secured many multi-million dollar settlements and verdicts in high-stakes personal injury cases. As a leader, he's fostered a firm culture of excellence, earning numerous accolades, including a perfect AVO rating of 10 and widespread recognition in the legal community. A born and bred Long Islander, Thomas is based out of Islip in Suffolk County, New York, where his firm handles personal injury, no-fault litigation, and other civil litigation matters. For the last 20 plus years, he has cemented his firm's culture and reputation for excellence, overseeing and managing all the practice areas within the firm. He personally oversees the entire team that handles high-stakes personal injury cases involving traumatic brain injuries, wrongful death, catastrophic injuries, falls, trucking accidents, and automobile accidents. Today, we touch upon scaling and growing a personal injury practice, along with the many facets to him and the practice. Thomas, welcome to Trial Lawyer View, and thank you for being with me today on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
I know that you're probably bundled up because it's pretty darn cold in the Northeast right now. Not sure if by the time we air the episode, it'll still be as cold there, but I know that feel a bit of an Arctic blast going on.
Yes. Yeah. And you have to forgive my informal attire. We just came off of a trial last week. And even though I wasn't trying the case, I went for client support and team support, and it was exhausting. I mean, it was just a brutal, brutal schedule. So I think I'm still recovering.
I get it. I do remember. It's been a long time since I've tried a case. I mean, back in my early career days, but I still handle a few things in our administrative courts here for Medicaid liens. So I do get it a little bit. I wanted to start off with a little something that's personal to you. You're a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm curious, has your training and moving through the belts influence your leadership style, business approach, and your personal injury practice?
It's actually had a tremendous impact on the business leadership style, on the practice of law, on all of it. I always say that of all the things I've done in my life, that degree, the black belt degree, which hangs on my wall, I'm looking over there to my right in my office, and it's in my office at work as well. It was probably the most valuable thing I ever did because money can't buy it. I remember when I started, I picked it because it was brutally hard. And I picked it and started it, I want to say around 38 years old, I'm 56 now, because it was known as one of the top three most challenging, most brutal martial arts. Don't ask me what, you know, went off in my head to do that. So how it impacted me was it taught me humility. At a time I needed to be humbled, it taught me to slow down, believe it or not. There's a saying that you'll hear frequently in jiu-jitsu, which is go slow to go fast, which is a tremendous leadership principle, right? It teaches you to breathe, calm down, slow down, breathe. So it's had tremendous impact, tremendous, tremendous impact.
Can identify being a long-term competitive cyclist. I found there were so many things about the disciplines around that that helped me in business. Humility is certainly one of those things because you get humbled all the time, whether it's your own body or someone that's faster than you, better than you. I'm sure you've experienced that in jiu-jitsu. And more recent years when I quit bike racing after I got hit by a car while cycling and had my own personal injury case, I got into something even safer. I race cars now. And
oh, geez.
and I instruct others. I teach others when they're just starting out to drive on track. But for me, it's a lot of those same principles, like in that idea of going slow to go fast, really understanding line. And, you know, there's so many things that you can take from those things that apply so well to making sure that your business is operationally sound. And frankly, you're the best leader you can be too.
There was also another parallel that I use all the time between jiu-jitsu and business and life in general, which is always go back to the fundamentals, right? Like, you can be super fancy in jiu-jitsu, but there are certain fundamental moves that will just work. And it's the same thing with business. I always go back to the cornerstone four fundamentals, what I consider the four fundamentals of business leadership. And then everything else is just an iteration on the fundamentals.
Yeah, it's great, great advice. And there's so many opportunities for us to learn, whether it's something through that, or I know that you do a lot of mastermind and those sorts of things that really help, you know, make sure that you have somewhat of a focus, whether it's not a direct focus, like some kind of athletic pursuit or things that we're talking about, different hobbies or, you know, in the business world, those opportunities to focus on things that are really fundamental that you're not doing in your daily routines because there's not enough time to focus on things like that.
Yeah, for sure. Look, again, one of the biggest takeaways, and there's so many, but talk about building resilience. And I think we are now in our 24th year of business. We opened in 2001. I've been practicing since 94. You need to be resilient, right? You own a business. You know that not every day is a win. And if you're not resilient through the ups and downs of business ownership, then you're probably not going to be in business for long. You know, so I took that from jiu-jitsu too, you know, just grace under pressure and resilience.
Yeah. Good segue into the question I was going to ask you, because, you know, over the past 24 years, you've successfully managed and overseen a multifaceted practice, personal injury practice. And I'm curious, what, if any, key strategies you've implemented that have ensured your success and growth? You know, because you're operating in a pretty competitive space and in a major metro area where there's a lot of competition.
Yeah. So I think the core principles are, for me, it's always the basics. It's managing my time. It's the four, again, going back to the four pillars, basically: time management, money management, people management, and marketing, right? And just iterations of those four pillars. Does that answer your question? I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because had Bill Hauser from SMB Team on the podcast a few months ago, and he was talking about very similar pillars of using those as a way to successfully grow and scale a practice.
Yeah, and I think also, like, one of the core fundamentals for me is I implement fast. I'm fast on action, but I'm patient with results. Right. So I have a fantastic second in command, Janira. And so she's great on execution. And so I let her run execution on her timetables. I tend to be a little more on the impatient side. What I do like is now we build legs under us every time we level up. We build legs under us so there's no backsliding. Right. So that's been a core thing as well. Because, you know, like with anything, there's challenges, right? So you level up, stuff breaks, you level up, stuff breaks. So you got to let the company catch up and build almost a table at the next level before you then look for what's the next iteration.
When did you determine that you needed someone like a second in command that can really make sure execution happens?
Very early on. I was lucky. I found Janira. I always tell the story, but I'll tell it again if you think it's interesting. At the time, it was just me and a legal assistant, I'll say, or a receptionist, because I didn't know the difference back in the day. So right around 2002, call it 2003, and she was in the ladies' restroom, and she came in and she said, there's a girl, because Janira was a kid at the time, there's a girl in the bathroom crying, she needs a job. And I'm like, bring her in, we'll hire her. I knew nothing about anything related to HR or anything. So Janira's been with me for it'll be 21 years this year. I got lucky. I didn't know she had a degree in business leadership, in law firm management, any of this stuff. She had degrees that I didn't even realize were there. And she started as my first true paralegal. And we had great chemistry at work and we developed a great working style over the decades. But I knew very early on my weaknesses. I'm not an execution person, right? I'm great. I was always a very detail-oriented lawyer. And I was hyper-competitive. So that led to great results all the time. And I was trying cases back in the day. But to answer your question pointedly, I've always known that I needed that second right-hand person to do the stuff that I'm not great at. I'm not great at execution. I'm just not.
It's so important to realize that, because without having those skill sets, you know, there's things that can be lacking in the way a business operates. And, you know, I think there are quite a few personal injury practices out there that you see that are operating in a way where they don't have the right people in the right seats. And that's such an important business concept. But, you know, yes, in the practice of law, you sometimes, especially in the personal injury practices, there's not that focus on operating the firm as a business. And that's a really important thing when you want to scale and grow. You really have to have some of those foundational elements and start building the team. Because like you said, having the legs under the table is so important if you're really going to start to scale and grow a firm.
Yeah. And listen, I make mistakes, right? Like, it's not easy and it's definitely not flawless. But I will tell you that I've been hearing horror story after horror story right now. Law firm owners who are really personal injury lawyers that have had the zero business training, and they are moments away from implosion. They are moments away from either going out of business or they're gone out of business and they're transferring files all around because they think it's easy, right? So they think, oh, I'm a great lawyer. I'm going to be a great business person. And that is not the case. And if you look at, and I'm not saying I'm great, but if you look at somebody like me or the other people that are really well known in the field, who you know actually, Craig Goldenfarb or Seth Price or any of the business leaders of a firm, decades have been spent studying this stuff, right? A guy made a comment, I'm looking to acquire practices. And somebody made a comment to me, hey, you know what you're doing looks like you're having fun. I think I'm going to try it. And I'm like, okay, and I'll see you in 20 years because that's how long it took me to get here, right? Yeah. You know, right now it runs well. It runs well. I can go away for weeks at a time. It will run without me after 21, 20, I've been doing it 25 years. And I've been paying a lot of money for the coaching I got. And I've been in the same classes as Craig Goldenfarb, Seth Price, and people I just mentioned. So, you know, I feel bad when I hear those horror stories. I do. I hear those horror stories of a lawyer. Somebody told me last night, a lawyer was inheriting an inventory of cases from another lawyer who couldn't sustain the business and was going out of business. And he thought he was going to get rich. And he paid somebody an exorbitant amount of money as his lawyer, only to find out 50% of the cases were fraudulent. And I'm like, did anybody think to do due diligence or any of the standard best practices a business owner should do? I want to acquire a business. I have an acquisitions team. I'm not doing the due diligence. I'm not the one who's going to strike the deal. I'm going to have somebody broker it. I'm going to have somebody involved with valuation, all of those things. And I think too many people are caught up in, You know, they look at somebody who's doing it. Oh, it looks easy. It looks fun. Yeah, it is fun and easy after 25 years of pain and learning and investment. So, you know, I would just caution anybody that, you know, there are a lot of practices right now that are in trouble, don't even know how much trouble they're in.
Yeah, the importance of sound business fundamentals and practices is, you know, I mean, everything you just talked about. And yeah, that leads me into something else I was going to ask you about, because I think it's very important as well, and probably a key component of it, which is, you know, having a strong culture and, you know, this idea of excellence. And I'm curious, for you, how have you fostered that and maintained that culture while managing, you know, to grow and scale a practice?
It all comes back to the core values, right? It comes back to knowing yourself, self-awareness, and then organizational awareness. Who are you as an organization? Do you have true core values, or are they aspirational words on a wall, right? And so we're constantly checking for alignment, not only of the people in the seats, right? The get it, want it. So you have right person means that they align with the core values. Right seat means get it, want it, capacity to do it. Do they understand the job? Do they want the actual job? And do they have the capacity to do it? So culturally, I'm obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with culture, because now seeing where we've gone after 2.25 years on EOS, I see how strong our culture is organically. And it was not an easy 2.5 years, let's call it, because we turned over a lot of different seats, a lot of different people in those seats. So culture to me drives everything. Culture is profit. Culture is profitable, but you have to invest in developing that culture, developing the people, and being willing to do what it takes. That is really hard, really hard. I've become obsessed now. Bill Umansky just turned me on to the concept of cultural alignment for people that are being off-boarded. And he's kind of got me thinking, like, that's a pretty magical thing, that if people are not in alignment where they're staying, how do you maintain those relationships, build those relationships, so it's not the end, it's just a different iteration of the relationship. So Bill's got me thinking, you know, he's got me thinking about that. But it's all cultural. It's all cultural.
Bill's a great guy, and much so believe in the power of culture. And that's something I've really dedicated a lot of my time to here at Synergy, continuing to focus on that, particularly using my experiences in my own personal injury case to drive home the importance of what every single person does in this organization to help touch the lives of someone that's been injured. Because, you know, we're like you, we get the opportunity and privilege to help people ultimately at the end of the case net as much as they possibly can, because we all know in most cases people don't get enough money truly to take care of themselves. It's few and far between where somebody gets 100% compensation, right? And so, you know, that, but driving that culture so that people understand, you know, why they come in every day to sit at their desk and who they're helping, who they're serving, why it's all so important, is such a critical component of a business, because that's how you get buy-in. That's how you get people going that extra mile, which is what you want.
Yeah, I mean, look, culture is a shared set of values, a belief in the same vision and mission, right? So people come on sometimes and they go, oh, that sounds all good. But you know right away if people really align, if people want the same things. And, you know, our core values are concrete. So we tell people straight up, look, it sounding good to you is not the same thing as you aligning with it. And if you don't align, it's not going to last. So don't fluff your way through interviews. I'd rather you just say, look, this is not for me. It's challenging. You know, personal injury is getting more and more challenging every day. Clients are in a bad spot and they need help, and they don't understand that, oh, when you settle a case, you're only 75% of the way there. If you're lucky, maybe 60% of the way there. That the lien resolution phase, which you're a specialist in, takes forever and has gotten more complicated. I know a lot of law firms just ignore it. right up until the federal government comes knocking. They're like, oh, we dispersed funds. We're like, okay, you can pay us, right, to the law firms. Whereas, like, we've always been very, very cognizant of the that last 25%. And now what we've gotten much more focused on and better at is communicating that earlier in the case to the client, like in the beginning. Hey, by the way, here's a timeline. And just because it settles or just because there's a verdict, that doesn't mean you get a check tomorrow. And as we improve in client communication, it improves client satisfaction, right? That's what clients want. They want to be kept in the loop. And it's challenging. It's really hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. It's, you know, sort of leads into the next question, which is, you know, with your practice, how have you faced the biggest challenges to ensure that your clients receive the best possible compensation and ultimate outcome in what is typically a very life-altering situation?
The biggest challenge is scaling quality. So what we've tried to do is put systems in place that over time will become a very consistent adherence to the quality assurance that we want, right? And what I mean by that is at some point we had the epiphany, like, we're never going to be great at lien resolution. It's not our space. But now you and a foot, and like there may be two or three other vendors that are really doing it in volume come along. And so now it's built into our retainer. Liens are a part of your personal injury journey. And here's a document that's going to show you your journey. And we don't do liens. It's not part of what we do. We're not experts at it. And for the nominal fees of this third-party vendor, you or another vendor, let's say, you know, Synergy or another vendor, for the nominal fees, we don't make money on that. But yeah, they have to get paid, and these issues will need to be addressed. We do now have a point person within the firm, who I think you spoke with, Darby. We have a point person, an attorney within the firm, because as you level up talent, different parts of the process become a choke point, right? So I brought on almost a year ago now a trial team. And these lawyers are like nothing I've ever seen. I mean, for the, I could not be prouder of the lawyers I have working with me. And that goes for all of them, right? All of the lawyers with us now, just different lawyers. But when you hire a team of assassins like that, and all of a sudden 40 cases settled in 2 months, you're sitting on accounts receivable the length of your arm. You're like, this is awesome. You don't realize, oh, wait a minute. You got 40 cases now that you got to process for liens, releases, all these different things. So it's just being the leader is constantly shifting the magnifying glass from choke point to choke point. And that's just what it is. But to answer your question is what we have also excelled in is, okay, is there an expert out there that provides an add-on service? Because all we're retained for is personal injury. So it's not a profit center doing liens for us. It's not our business. We're not good at it. And that becomes who can I hire on behalf of the client, right? And so I have found it indispensable in the marketplace, vendors like yourself. Really, your book was unbelievable to me because you have the two different lien resolution books now. You have the second version coming out, right, shortly?
Correct.
And it's The Art of Settlement, right? Did I get it right? Okay. So I read it cover to cover. I made it mandatory reading for the attorney in my office who does it because, you know, trying to explain it to an associate attorney, it's a whole new world. She wasn't dealing with the back end of the cases. So she's picked it up and she knows. I'm like, look, you can call whatever vendor you want to assist you. It's not on you to do it. It's on you to make sure it gets done.
Absolutely. It's, you know, amazing to me that more law firms don't avail themselves of some great vendors, not just us, but, you know, things that can accelerate their practices, make it more efficient, make it more profitable, and insulate from potential liability points. Because just doing something that a law firm has traditionally done just because it's traditionally been done by a law firm, you know, it doesn't make sense from a business perspective. From a business perspective, you look at who do I partner with that is going to make my business better and better for my clients, better outcomes. So, you know, it's such a critical thing to be evaluating as a business owner. We have to do it all the time. And so, you know, that's that's just part of it. It's part of the,
yeah.
Part of being a leader in a business is really understanding that and implementing things that make things better for your own team and for the clients you serve.
Yeah. So that's a big part of it for me, is because I don't want to be the guy doing any of it. I'm not going to be the guy doing any of it. And so I have to think in compartmentalization in the systems, right? What phase is the case at? Where are normally the market talks to you, right? Like I never take client complaints or client issues negatively. I don't get defensive. I go, okay, there's a reason I have an upset client. Let's look at the system. Did it break down somewhere? Right. And if it broke down somewhere and it's not part of what we are getting paid to do, then who can we offload that to? Who will do it better? Whose niche is it if it's not our niche? Right. And so that served us really well in scaling.
So you have a podcast which offers insights into the world of personal injury law in the practice, and it touches on business strategies and leadership. I was recently on the podcast, which was great. I was curious if there's anything that you've learned collectively from all the guests that you've had on the Tona Law podcast.
Yes, absolutely. So I created the podcast for people 20 years down the road from me, you know, where they're just starting out. Right? They're just starting their practice. They're considering starting their practice. And what I wanted to do was get people on the podcast that I'm in the rooms with, let's say, that somebody just starting out would never be in those rooms or even aware of the rooms that are out there. So I've learned a ton of stuff from every person on that podcast. I mean, I've had people on the podcast took a $107 million verdict. Saturday morning, I was texting with a gentleman who's in my inner circle. He's crossing the 10-figure mark for his law firm. And it was a great perspective in that text exchange, because I'm in circles with multiple 7-figure and 8-figure and 9-figure earners. That's the first 10-figure one. And so I'm able to send a text message saying, listen, no matter how good you think you are, there's a young gun coming up behind you. And it just created a lot of context. So the guests I have on, people that I wanted to get to know well, who are now friends. Right. And it was in conjunction with traveling to all the conferences and masterminds with those same people, building a LinkedIn presence and doing a podcast. And then this way it developed awareness across the country, both of me, the podcast, my law practice, and also the people and guests I have on. I have learned a tremendous amount.
It's a really great opportunity to learn for yourself from people that, you know, are pretty amazing at what they do. So if we have lawyers listening to this that are considering starting their own law firm podcast, what advice do you have about creating content that resonates with the audience?
I think authenticity, right? Like with me, I'm not the most polished and I tend to curse a little bit, but they bleep it out all the time on my podcast and I'm being good on yours. I think you have to know who you are. Because if you don't, the market knows, right? People know if you're not authentic. So like a young friend of mine just started his own podcast. He's a couple of years out and he's documenting the journey and he's now getting guests on that are ahead of him by 5-10 years or multiple 7 figures because he's an associate at a law firm, but he's hungry. So he's starting it for his peers to have access to rooms that guys like me have opened up for him, you know, to bring awareness to those people. And he's authentic about it. He talks about his pain points and stuff like that. So I think you have to know your demographic if you're looking to start a podcast. You have to stick with it. It's a lot of work, you know. You have your podcast. It's a lot of work. And you have to stick with it. Most podcasts fizzle after 10 episodes.
Yeah, it was funny. I was in search of a new editing solution for our podcast. And I was talking to someone actually overseas, someone in Ireland, of all places. And he was like, you know, I'm so impressed that you've gotten, I think we're at 60 or 70 episodes, something like that. And he's like, you know, the majority of them fizzle out after 10 to 20 episodes, which I wasn't even kind of a thought in my head that there was some sort of accomplishment in getting to 50 or 60 episodes. Cause I just have fun with it. And love doing it and love talking to people like you that, you know, I learn things from and get the opportunity just to chat for a brief little bit about something that I'm very interested in, which is operation of law firms, you know? So
to me, it's
really cool. I wanted to ask you about your building a reputation and excellence and the accolades that you've received in doing so. What has driven you to continually push the firm towards these highest of standards in terms of your practice?
The driving principle for me is crystal clear at this point. I want the type of law firm that if I was critically injured, I would choose those lawyers to represent me. Kind of a there before the grace of God goes I. And it was born from handling more and more wrongful death cases and being kept up at night and finally figuring out that I was being kept up at night because while I was a certain level of lawyer, trial lawyer, right? Which to me, while it's not a differentiator to the general public maybe, right? It for sure is when you're choosing a lawyer. In the market, only 1% of lawyers have ever tried a case, right? And then if you believe like the cream of the crop trial lawyers, they'll tell you, and less than half of them don't know how to try it the right way, right? So that puts you in a very narrow, narrow lane. And for the general public, or even if you're a referring attorney like yourself, right? Like you have an estates practice, you get a PI case in, a wrongful death case. Do you want to just send it to somebody who has slick marketing, or do you want to send it to somebody who has trial lawyers there? Right? They don't have to be the biggest, but they have to be trial lawyers in my mind. So I've tried cases to verdict a very long time ago. A lot of them, fair amount, right? Fair amount. Both liability and damages because in New York, it's bifurcated. But then I went through a long stretch where I was into the business of it and I had associates working for me. And to me, one of the wrongful death cases that came in 2 years ago before I started EOS, 2.5 years ago, the woman, I couldn't sleep. She was mid-50s, her husband was mid-50s, and he died in a one-car accident, but we believe there was alcohol involved and potentially dram shop, all of that. And I realized that unless I was going to handle the case, at the time, I just did not have the level of lawyer I needed to properly handle that. And I kept asking myself, if I was that plaintiff, because it could have been me, right? Let's say any of us, it could be. Would I want my wife to hire a law firm? And that then became my guiding light. And you had a significant accident. I remember reading about it in your book. So I know you can relate to that, right? Like even for your own company, once a law firm is ready to settle a case, you're going to handle it the way you would want somebody to handle it for you.
Yep. No, I mean, it's that to me is the right way, right? Because ultimately treating the clients like you would, you know, if it were someone in your family that this happened to. I know just in my experience, I had a friend, obviously I know a lot of personal injury lawyers, had a friend that handled my case. So maybe there's a different dynamic, but still, I mean, you know, the other people in his practice who I dealt with, his paralegal, you know, and others in the firm, similar experience though was, like I knew that it was being handled the right way. And that's what you want and expect if you've been through something like this. That's what you deserve.
Yeah. If you're trying cases, you won't win every trial. You just won't. But the clients know. The clients know, hey, you guys left it all out there. I mean, you went in, you spent the money on the expert. You did everything you could do. That client, yeah, the results of course matter. They're not going to be happy if they didn't get the right verdict for themselves. But there's a lot you can't control with trials. You can't control judges' rulings. Sometimes they get it right. Sometimes you end up on appeal, right? So, but you can't control the effort that goes in, right? And then that comes down, as I'm thinking about it, I'm processing it with you. Like you talk about right person, right seat, right? You could have the right person that thinks they want to be part of this fantastic picture, right? And I always use the example of that get it, want it capacity to do it, right? To be a trial lawyer, my trial lawyer and his right-hand person that did this trial last week, I was exhausted just watching them, right? And they were working 16, 18 hour days. So while a young attorney might look at them and go, I want to be part of that. Well, are you walking out at 5:01 every night when trial's coming? Because these seasoned trial lawyers, they're not doing that. They're not doing that. So then it comes down to, do you really align with what it takes to get there? You know, and the clients don't care. They just want to know they're being fought for.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've built a successful practice from the ground up. What is one key piece of advice that you would give to trial lawyers who are looking to scale their firm without compromising the commitment to the clients and values?
That's an interesting question, because you said, what advice would you give the trial lawyers doing it, right? Here's what I would say. You can't do both. So you got to pick a lane. If you want to be the trial lawyer, then find a business owner or a CEO. Like a friend of mine, I'm so excited for the guy. He was one of my executive coaches for the longest time. He's becoming a fractional CEO of a company, right? So you cannot do both. I'm going to say, I don't say a lot of things with certainty, but the best trial lawyers I know, that's their lane. They don't want to do what I do. The thought of it makes them cringe, actually. KPI reporting, finance arrangements, all the stuff that I do on a daily basis, that looks easy, but it's not. And it's a different skill. So the advice I would give any lawyer, let's just use the word lawyer for a second, is if you love trying cases, then figure out a chief operating officer or a chief executive officer role, pay them a lot of money. Or if you love the business like I do, get yourself a trial team and pay them a lot of money. Either way, wrap your head around, it's going to cost you a big investment, and it's a good investment if it's in the right people, because you will make immediate ROI. My trial team was the best investment I made, highest sticker I ever paid for talent. I wish I had done it 10 years ago.
Beautifully said and done. You reworded a question that I inartfully worded, but perfect point is that the key piece of advice is invest in the right people in your organization at the end of the day, right? Now that's for you, that's the trial team. For someone else, it might be, hey, I'm going to be the leader of the trial team, but I need a CEO or a CEO yes. of my practice. And I can't tell you how many guests I've had that talk about exactly that is, and you know, Craig Goldenfarber, a mutual friend, talks about his transition to that and realizing his practice needed it. Having sat in the CEO role myself, it's you cannot operate without that role. It is operate a true business, I should say. You may have a law practice, but you don't necessarily have a business without someone that really is fulfilling that role somehow, some way.
I look at it, and again, I own passive investments. I look at it as it's only a business if it runs without me, right? If it depends on me, I don't have a business. I have either a job or a practice. And then the other, there's a bunch of different things that I can attribute a lot of this to, but the other piece would be, regardless of what lane of travel you're in, what I have learned is having a right-hand person. So for me, on the business side, it's Janira. She's an incredible integrator / COO. We're like the perfect complement. On the trial side, the epiphany that we've all had is there's a reason why most defense firms show up with two lawyers. And on the plaintiff side, if you're the trial person, have a second chair, have a second set of eyes in that courtroom every day, because they will see things you will not. They will pick up pieces you will not. And so that second seat role, whether it's trial or business, is incredibly important. It's incredibly important.
It's funny, you know, this idea that if you can't walk away from your business without it not being able to function, then you don't own anything. The business owns you, right?
Yes. And yeah.
That point that you made is such a critical one to understand if you're going to build any type of business. And you've alluded to it and talked about it briefly, but this idea of having some sort of operating system to run your business on. We realized early on we needed something like EOS Traction. We implemented, and a lot of guests I've had come on, talk about those things, either running on something like that or building something off of that, like Mike Morse did. These are people that are very successful, like you, that have built things. And if you don't have that, then again, that it being able to operate without you having your hand in everything is unlikely. And if it does, it's probably not operating well and achieving what you want it to achieve. So that's such a critical foundational component that you hit upon in terms of growing and scaling. Okay, so we've been going for a bit. I'm mindful of your time. I wanted to ask you one last question and completely open-ended, talk about whatever you want. Because it's Trial Lawyer View, I always ask, what's your view as a trial lawyer? And maybe this should be what's your view as a CEO of a law firm. So however you want to answer the question.
Again, as a former trial lawyer, now owner of a firm that tries cases, one, if you're going to do personal injury, approach each case as if it's going to be tried, right? That's what is fair to the client. That's what gets the best results. And even if you can't afford a trial team, have a trial strategy that includes an external trial person, that's all they do, these trial for gun, attorneys that are out there. They're out there, and yes, you give up a big piece of the action, and you should, because they earn their money. Trials are really, really hard. The other thing I would say, depending on, who's listening to this, is this. There's a lot of bad advice out there, and I cringe when I see a Facebook post and somebody is posting anonymously because they're embarrassed, and they go, listen, I'm 2 years out of school and I'm thinking about hanging my shingle. I would almost always advise against that. I believe in the 10,000 hour rule. If you don't put in 10,000 hours into personal injury, and if you are not trying cases, how will you ever compete out in that space? Right? And you don't know what you don't know. That's literally what one person said in a Facebook post today. I don't know what I don't know. Should I do it? You're asking the wrong questions. Where can I go to learn for the next 5 years that I will put in 10,000 hours and become an expert? Just be patient. The advice that's out there, I cringe. I feel bad because they're setting up so many people, right? Like we just talked about earlier, the amount of experienced lawyers who are struggling in personal injury firms of their own because they have not spent time and money on themselves to learn the business end of it and then pick the lane they want to go in. And now you got a younger generation, 1 year, 2 years out, and they're going, I'm just going to hang a shingle. It's easy. Oh my God. Like it's frightening to me. So just be careful. Go slow. Like what's the hurry? I was trying cases and I was doing it for 5 years. And that's about the 10,000 hours of pure personal injury before I opened up. And then I was able to set up systems and processes around trials because I was doing it, So that's basically it. That's what I would say as the owner of a trial firm now.
Well, you dropped a lot of knowledge. Thank you. And if anyone's listening to the podcast and wants to talk to you about any of the things that you've discussed today, or if they've got a case in your neck of the woods, I don't know if it's just like the island or if you're in Manhattan or you tell, if somebody's got a case up in New York where your geographic boundaries are, but wants to, work with your firm, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way would be my cell phone. You can text me. I'll give you my cell phone, 631-264-5909. You can go to my website, tonallaw.com. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I'm on there every day. So you could just DM me on LinkedIn. We do have people referring us across the country. We pay fee participation wherever it's permitted. And, the day we get paid, you get paid. So, this was fun, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, we'll include all the contact information in the show notes for today's episode. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Trial Lawyer View.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.